Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. And it's Monday. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. And my dad will be calling in to tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. And, movie reviews are coming up in just a couple of seconds. We are also, in honor of Fate of the Furious, which just came out this weekend, we're going to talk about great car movies and great movie cars of the past. That will be coming up on the show. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. And, and you can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show and follow us on Facebook, which is the best way to stay connected, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, it is Monday morning, and that means it is time to talk box office a little bit later on and review the new movies, which we're going to do right now. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more join me every week to talk movies. And let's bring Eric in. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
All right. Good morning. Let's start with this foreign film that I will not be able to pronounce. That Colin is that Cézanne et moi?
It is.
Okay.
We can leave it at that.
Okay.
Cézanne et moi.
Yeah.
Cézanne and I is the American version of that title. There's a French film that centers around two 19th century artists. One is a novelist named Emile Zola, and the other is a painter named Paul Cézanne. And the film starts in 1888, when the two had a falling out and are meeting again for the first time in many years, recounting their early days together. And the film flashes back to when they were younger and growing up as people and as artists through the next few decades. Emile was more successful in his day as a novelist than Cézanne was in his day as a painter. He was quite belligerent. Cézanne was quite belligerent. He refused to play by the rules of the art world. He had a rocky marriage. He lived off his rich parents, who resented his rebellious ways, and he was basically just a hard guy to be around. But Emile stuck by his side because he saw greatness in him and, you know, tried to encourage him. But eventually Cézanne's behavior became too much even for him. So if neither of these names sound familiar to you, that's, you know, maybe not surprising if you haven't taken a French literature or an art history class in your life, because I haven't. I never knew who these guys were. I'm pretty ignorant in both of these things. So Cézanne was basically, you know, one of the most influential, ended up being, you know, a very influential painter. You know, even Van Gogh cited him as, you know, a major influence on him. He was an important guy. So any movie about this subject is going to be, you know, an education for me. As such, I thought this film accomplished more as a character study than as a history lesson, which is okay, I guess, because, the movie doesn't go to great lengths to tell us that Cézanne is a genius. It waits till the very end to tell us that, you know, what he ended up being. Because as a movie about the relationship between these two guys, I thought it worked because, there's a lot going on here for a movie that is about, you know, resentment and rebellion and being famous in your time versus being famous after your time. And what are the sacrifices and, you know, the pros and cons of such a thing? That's the stuff that you think about on the way out of the theater. I can't say I learned much about Cézanne's art or even Emile's abilities as a storyteller. But what I did learn about these two guys is I found the relationship between them quite interesting. In that respect, I think the movie works. It's a gorgeously produced film. It's beautifully shot. It is, it is the kind of movie that, you know, would be nominated for art direction and costume design and all that stuff that period pieces get, you know, that are known for. It definitely gets all that stuff. All that stuff is great to look at, and it's a beautiful score too. So, you know, if for people who want to learn about the art form, it's a disappointment. There's really no getting away around that, because it doesn't really teach the viewer much on that subject. But as a film about a relationship between these two guys, I thought it was very interesting. So on that basis, I would recommend it.
Okay. It's playing at two theaters. It's playing at the Glen Art Theater in Glen Ellen and at the Landmark Renaissance in Highland Park. So there you go, Cezanne and I. All right. Do we know anything about the filmmakers?
I looked her up. Danielle Thompson made it, and I looked at her filmography. She's made 6 films. I've never seen any of them, so I don't know. Maybe they're a little too French for us, but I don't. I'm looking at these titles, and I don't recognize any of them. You know, she wrote and directed this, and I don't know. That's about all I can say.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, Eric, why don't you tell us about Mission Control, the Unsung Heroes of Apollo?
Yeah. So speaking of history lessons, this movie is exactly what it purports to be. It's a documentary about another, you know, many documentaries about, you know, the NASA space missions, in this case, the Apollo missions that began very tragically with the deaths of Gus Grissom and the other astronauts in what was the Apollo 1 mission. It sort of takes us from there as we sort of meet many of the surviving members of this period. There's a kind of a striking shot very early on that shows the empty mission control room that is filled with just a few key members who are still around from that period. And they all begin to tell their stories about this particular time in history and the challenges that came upon them, mainly in the moment, putting on these different missions. You know, it goes from Apollo 1 and then leads us right up to the ill-fated Apollo 13 mission, and does a pretty nice job in sort of recreating a lot of these situations. I mean, the really tightly edited sequences and things that with footage we've never seen before, some stories that didn't quite know how harrowing some of these flights actually got that weren't exactly reported in mass, which is always very interesting to hear about. I'm very much a sucker for this period in history, space flight and all the stories that go along with them. I'm incredibly fascinated with. This movie might have the unfortunate timing in that it's coming out right after Hidden Figures. And you hear the title of this movie, The Unsung Heroes of Apollo. And here we had Hidden Figures that, you know, was all about the, you know, the African-American women who were very much a part of the behind the scenes. Of course, we've seen the pictures and the videos of the men who were in control of Mission Control at the time. And so it's not like this is some extensive whitewashing thing. It's history. Any sort of comparisons between the two and, you know, thinking that this is somehow some sort of tone-deaf reevaluation to give the white men credit for anything, that's just kind of bollocks. These things happen. This is history. And, you know, I think that if anyone who is, you know, a student of this particular period or has any interest, you know, even just after seeing movies like Hidden Figures or Right Stuff or Apollo 13, are going to find something really interesting in this film. So I definitely recommend it, particularly to those who are as interested in this stuff as I am.
Okay. It's out now, and you can actually watch it on Amazon. You can watch it on the video on demand, and that's Mission Control, The Unsung Heroes of Apollo. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got to take a break here for the news, and then after the news, we got two more movies to review here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with your opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Monday morning means Monday morning movie reviews, and we got two more movies to review. And then Eric and I will hang out and talk about the box office for the weekend. And we'll tell you about that. Who were the winners? Who were the losers? All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And Colin and Eric, let's get back to the movies. And here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello.
All right, Colin, why don't you tell us about The Fate of the Furious?
Well, this is the 8th Fast and the Furious film, and everyone is back for it, except for Paul Walker, of course. And this one, Vin Diesel is confronted by Charlize Theron, who convinces him to join her and betray his family, including his wife, with whom he had just had his honeymoon in Cuba. But Dom is, that's the Vin Diesel character, Dom. He has little choice because he has something personal at stake. So he's forced to join with Charlize Theron and basically do everything she says. And he's forced to betray everyone who's close to him and be on the wrong side of the law or whatever this time. Eventually, everyone from the franchise returns after starting new lives, you know, more normal than they've been before. And along with Kurt Russell, they try to get Dom back into their family and away from Charlize Theron's character, who's involved in big terrorist plot that I don't want to get into. But all this involves a lot of computer hacking and submarines and tundras of Russia, car chases in New York, Jason Statham being taken out of prison, which was supposed to hold him for eternity under 10 feet of concrete surrounding him. But they let him out for this. The Rock is back. He's coaching Little League at the beginning. Just everybody's back to try and bring Vin Diesel back into the family. You know, this is the 8th time we're doing this, and it's pretty hard to top Furious 7, in my opinion. That was by far the best in the series. Other people like 5, I think, is another one that people like a lot. This is one of those that is going to just kind of not be distinguishable from all the other ones. I think Fast and the Furious 4, 5, and 6, I couldn't tell you which one was which or what happened and what. They all kind of blend together, and this doesn't help. The only way to distinguish this one is Charlize Theron is in it, and she's not driving anything, which doesn't make any sense to me. She spends most of the movie trying to get Vin Diesel to say the word family, and he's not budging. He's not having it. That's what it seems like to me. She's very conniving. She's the villain in the film. And she's trying to appeal to him and his ties to family, but it's not a very memorable villain. And this is not a very memorable entry into this franchise. I like when Fast and the Furious movies get outrageous and silly in the car chases. I really do. That's the best part about these films. And I really did enjoy the New York City part where one of the Theron's guys hacks into every car in the city and makes him drive around on his whim. I thought it was a very funny sequence. And then the whole thing with the submarine was over the top ridiculous, but not quite as much fun as the runway scene in, I think it was number six at the end. And so this is a movie directed by F. Gary Gray. I've never really been that impressed with his abilities in the action genre. I've always found his stuff kind of dry and, you know, just not that interesting. That's how this feels. Again, Furious 7 is a tough act to follow because that was beginning to end insanity and fun and action that was really beautifully made and just a lot of fun. And then this is kind of back to the formula of two scenes I remember, but then the rest is kind of filler that I just doesn't mean anything to me at all, much like a lot of these films. So this is a pretty generic entry into this franchise, and I'd say you can wait.
All right. Eric?
It took 7 films in this franchise for me to finally get on board with them, and I'm really happy to hear that I'm not alone in thinking that Furious 7 happens to be the best of the bunch. And a primary reason for that is because I think it has the best director of the bunch in James Wan, a guy that even though you put aside the insanity of, you know, what he's concocting, he at least concocts them with a degree of skill, and you just kind of go along for the ride, and you see that there's actually, you know, someone paying attention to, you know, the geographical ridiculousness of the action sequences. So then you come back to this one, and we've downgraded to F. Gary Gray, which, even though I've marginally liked a couple of his movies, I would not call him a great filmmaker by any stretch of the imagination. And this is a film that, you know, seems to have imagination, because it seems it's upping its game in a couple of these action sequences that Colin described. But they're pulled off with such little grace, very little fun. The story, you know, to complain that the story doesn't make any sense, or that anything in this movie is too over the top ridiculous to, you know, to suspend your disbelief, then you're kind of doing it wrong, because that's pretty much been this series' MO. And one of the things that they managed to do when these movies started to get a sort of inch close to the seventh film and get a little bit better is they started adding cast members who at least energize this film a little bit. In the fifth one, they added The Rock. In the sixth one, Luke Evans actually made, you know, a memorable villain, which is saying something for this franchise. In the seventh film, you not only had James Wan behind the helm, but you brought in Statham. And when you bring in Jason Statham and he's delivering the most personality on screen, that's a problem. One of the only things that got me through Fate of the Furious and not, you know, bored me to tears was just imagining that Jason Statham was playing his character from Spy. And sometimes I think he is. I think by the end of this movie, where you have F. Gary Gray trying to, you know, concurrently do Mad Max Fury Road on ice combined with the climax to Hard Boiled, just not the director who should be trying to pull that stuff off. And like Colin said about Charlize Theron, I mean, all the casting that they've done in the last three movies leading up to this, and then they decide to put Charlize Theron in this movie, and you think, oh, cool, they're going to put her behind the wheel of a car because clearly they saw Fury Road like the rest of us. And then they just keep her on a plane barking orders for the entire movie. She doesn't make for an interesting villain. There's just nothing interesting about that character. It's really disappointing. I still don't quite understand why Vin Diesel has to keep everything secret from his family. I mean, I know there's stakes involved, but it seems like you might want to let somebody in on your gambit, because it seems like with what you're doing, you're going to end up in jail at some point. And if you know, the intelligence community is so intent on using street racers to prevent World War III, which is an actual line of dialogue from this movie, then maybe there is something to be said about the intelligence community, you know, the way Trump speaks of them. Because, this movie is just, I mean, Colin said generic, and that I think that might be an upgrade from what this movie actually is.
Okay, well, as a fan of pretty much all of the movies except Fast and Furious, I think, and the second one, which sucks. I enjoyed this one. I thought it was fine. It is not nearly as good as... I don't think 7 is the best one. I think 5 is the best one. That's the one where they're driving around with this with the... like you, Colin, I love these movies. I couldn't tell you what the plots were for any of them. They all just meld together. And that's fine with me, because I just go there to watch cars, you know, blow up. That's why I see these movies. But the one where they're dragging the safe down the street, the giant safe... That's the fifth one, I think.
It is.
That's my favorite one, and then 7 would be second, and then fifth would be third, and then this one would come in after the fifth one. Here's the deal: right at the beginning of the movie, you know what you're in for. The setup is absolutely ridiculous. The first race that they have, where basically Vin Diesel's in reverse going 90 in a car that's on fire, at that moment in the movie, that's it. You're in for it. You know, I mean, this is it. This is what you're saying. I agree with you that F. Gary Gray really doesn't have the chops or the imagination that even Justin Lin has, because Justin Lin is a pretty good director of these films as well. Very good director of these films. But there's a lot of imagination in the setups, and some of the staging is really, really great. And there are things in it that are just, I think, over the top hilarious. For instance, they stage a jailbreak for Kurt Russell's behind allowing a giant prison riot to happen. And that scene seems to serve no purpose other than to watch The Rock take, you know, rubber bullets and throw guys through walls and stuff. And I had fun watching that. And Jason Statham, you know, doing parkour and kicking guys in the face and stuff. I enjoyed watching all that. I thought it was fun. There's really no logical reason for it. There's no logical reason for anything that happens in these movies. I think that the camaraderie between the characters in this one seems more forced than any of them. Particularly with Tyrese, because his character is monumentally annoying, and hasn't really been that annoying in the other films, but in this one, you know, like every time they cut to him and he's got some smart ass answer or comment or something, it just seems really forced. The most natural comedy in the film happens whenever Kurt Russell walks in. Kurt Russell basically steals, you know, like in terms of like the scenes that don't involve, you know, cars and special effects and stuff blowing up, Kurt Russell owns it. Like, every time he walks in the room, you're like, oh, good, Kurt Russell's here. But he just seems to just show up. It's just, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like whenever whenever things start to slow down a little bit, there comes Kurt Russell, you know, and with his, you know, with his just, like, effortless charm. I also thought that Scott Eastwood was pretty funny in this movie too, and they had some fun with his character. And then as far as the set pieces go, the submarine thing is absolutely ridiculous. Some of it is really well executed, and you know, some of it is. I thought that extended crazy sequence on the ice, some of it was great. Particularly when Tyrese's car goes into the water and they've got it hooked up and they're trying to pull him out. I thought that was really cool, and you know, like The Rock redirecting a, you know, a missile, you know, that's always great. So that was a fun sequence. But that sequence in New York is great. That whole sequence in New York is great, where all the cars are going, are driving by themselves, they're falling out of windows. And then when they, you know, they hook up Vin Diesel's car and they're trying to rip the car apart and keep him, you know, that whole sequence I thought was great. So that whole extended sequence in New York is the best stuff in the movie and almost worth the price of admission. You know, and it's, you know, there's tough guy talk, you know, and I don't know how many times I lost track. I tried to count how many times they say family, which is, you know, obviously something that has been repetitive throughout this entire series of movies, but I lost track at like 100 by the time they say it. And yes, there's no question that Charlize Theron is wasted. When you put Furiosa, you cast Furiosa in a movie about cars, you put her behind the wheel, preferably of a rig, but they don't. And you're right. She stands around on the plane with a Bluetooth on, you know, and then, or sometimes she'll go get out of the way and she'll type on a keyboard because the other person couldn't hack as well as she could. And then there's a sequence where she's like dueling with one of the other people trying to start and not start a submarine. But, you know, and I had a good time with it. I did. And I will say this. It's not nearly as good as the last. It's weird to say. It's not as good as the last three. The last three are much better than this one. But it still has stuff in it that I really, really liked. And it is corny enough for me to even laugh at so many of the things. Like the whole reason for Dom doing what he does is just so ridiculous. Like it's such a like the secret, and I kind of want to give it away, obviously, but the secret as to why, you know, she's got him over a barrel is completely absurd and requires us to go back and remember that at one point, you know, they actually bring this up. One of the stupidest things they've ever done in this series was to kill off Michelle Rodriguez only to bring her back in the next movie. And they even remind us of that in this one. I was like, that's not a good thing, man. Don't remind us of the dumbest thing that's ever happened in this series. And that's basically the trigger for what is the secret, why Dom has to do all this crazy stuff. And there's also another part of the great part was, you know, just with the whole handling of the Russian ambassador who's got the nuclear codes. Just the whole idea of that even happening is just so absurd. So, yeah, it doesn't have as much polish and as much grace as the last one did. But I'm still enjoying it because there were set pieces that I really, really liked, especially the entire sequence in New York. So as a fan of the series, it's not a great one. It's definitely not as good as the last one, but I still found it entertaining enough and goofy enough to recommend. And I also love the fact that Helen Mirren shows up and no credit at all. So there's no credit. Now, did you guys stay through the credits?
Yeah.
Is there a scene after?
No.
Oh, there isn't. Okay.
Because I heard there was supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, I thought for sure there would be a scene. Well, I don't want to give anything away, but I thought for sure there would be a scene explaining what happened to one character who just literally jumps out, you know, like gone. And you never hear what happens. So I thought there would be at least a postscript, but we had to leave because I wanted to get home in time to watch that tremendous Hawks game from Saturday. So I'm recommending it. You guys are not, but I'm a goofball with these movies anyway. So all right, all right. So hang on, guys. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a film called Colossal, and stay tuned for that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We'll take a break here and come back with more on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Eric Childers and Colin Suter join me every week. Here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin.
Hello.
All right. Eric, tell us about Colossal.
Okay. I'm not going to tell you much about Colossal because I think this is a movie that the less you know, the more fun you're going to have with it.
I agree.
Yeah. So the basic setup is that Anne Hathaway plays an unemployed writer who likes to drink a lot, so much so that she ends up on the bad end of a breakup with her kind of lout of a boyfriend, played by Dan Stevens, and she ends up returning to her hometown, where she becomes reacquainted with a childhood friend of hers, played by Jason Sudeikis, who now owns or has inherited his father's bar, and he offers her a job at the bar, bartending, until she can sort of get her situation straightened out. She continues, you know, working in a bar is maybe not the greatest thing for an alcoholic, but she ends up, doing what she does, and she was walking home one day and discovers that a giant monster has started to destroy parts of South Korea. And I don't know, is that a good place to stop right there,
yeah,
or can we go a little further?
Stop.
Okay. So. Yeah. We're going to stop right there, folks.
Yeah.
And there's probably, you know, if you've seen trailers or if you heard people talk about this movie, you probably know a little bit more than we're going to tell you. But this is a movie that doesn't end there with that particular twist, because it has twist on top of twist that take this movie into such unexpected directions, some comical, some deadly serious, that this is a movie that will have you thinking about and wanting to see again at some point in the future. In fact, I saw this movie at the Toronto Film Festival last year. And when I saw the movie, I liked it very much. But there were parts of me that this movie, like I said, this movie takes a number of different turns. And there's a sort of a late turn that this movie takes that the first time I saw it, was a bit disappointed in. Not because I was upset that the movie had taken some, you know, turn into screenplay that I thought was irreconcilable. I was just disappointed in characters and their behavior and stuff like that. And it really got me thinking. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought about how ingenious the film actually is in the way it handles that situation. And that this is a movie that is not just about a really fascinating take on alcoholism, easily the most fascinating take since Edgar Wright's The World's End, but a film that also deals pretty, originally with relationships and misogyny and some really deeper, dark issues in a film that is a monster movie, a comedy, a romantic comedy, and then kind of a horror film and a deadly, serious drama at times. I think the performances in this movie are extraordinary. I think Anne Hathaway does some of the best work of her career in this movie. I've said before, Sudeikis has had a couple opportunities, comedies and not, in showing that he can be a guy, an actor doing leading man status, a movie like Sleeping with Other People. There's another movie recently he did with Rebecca Hall, I think Tumble Down was the name of it, that I like that movie too. And I think he does the best work of his career in movies, that is, in this. I think he is fantastic in this movie. And like you said, I mean, we want to talk about this movie further, and I'm sure we probably will be talking about this movie a little later in the year, perhaps even.
I can tell you that right now. Yes, we will.
Yeah, there you go. So spoiler alert for that. But I don't think that, we're not going to ruin anything for you now. All we're going to tell you is that see this movie hard and get to it while it's still in theaters, because so far it's one of the best movies of the year.
Okay. Colin, Eric, hang on, guys. We got to take a break. We got the news here, and then we'll come back. We'll get Colin's review of Colossal and then my review of Colossal coming up right here on WGN, and then follow that with some box office numbers. All right. We'll take a quick break. We got the news coming up next on WGN. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It is Monday morning. That means my dad will call in and tell a joke. It's a jokey time. And because Fate and the Furious came out this week, we are going to talk about the best car movies and best movie cars of all time. You can share those with us if you want at 312-981-7200, which is talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. And the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Before the break and before the news, Eric told us about a movie called Colossal with Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis. And he loved it. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
All right. And so, Colin, what is your take on Colossal?
Well, I'm glad Eric stopped with the plot synopsis when he did. If it was up to me, we wouldn't do the plot synopsis for this one, because I knew zilch going in. I never did see the trailer for this movie. I only saw the poster, and that's what I went in with. And I vaguely remembered Eric giving it a positive review from Toronto. And I think that's the way everybody should go in. Just don't know too much going in. But I think we gave up just enough. And because that was part of the joys of sitting through this is discovering it. I talked about a movie last week called Your Name, a Japanese animated film. And it was the same kind of experience where it was like, how are these two things going to come together? How is this going to resolve itself? Because even as the movie goes along, I found it impossible to predict. You know, just when I think a scene is going to go one direction, it goes in another direction. That's fun. I mean, that is a fun movie going experience when you have that. And you buy into it because you buy into the characters. And that's the case of what happens here. Anne Hathaway is an alcoholic, but she's not your cliche movie alcoholic. She's a damaged person, but they don't go, you know, over the top and or try to over-explain her behavior or anybody's behavior in this film. And I could see what Eric was saying about when you watch it, you're kind of disappointed at one point in some of the characters and their decisions. And I felt that same feeling. And as the film went along, it made more sense to me what it was really about. And this is, you know, a movie about alcoholism and, you know, and codependency and why people end up staying in bad relationships. And I thought the movie was pretty ingenious in how it develops that through metaphors and through the simple, illogical story that if you only think about it on a surface level, it doesn't make that much sense. But if you're watching it, thinking about these things, it makes a complete sense. I thought that was just ingenious the way it was presented. These ideas were presented. It's directed by Nacho Vigalondo, who is a filmmaker. I've not seen all of his films. I saw Time Crimes. I thought that was pretty good. I never did see the Elijah Wood, Sasha Gray movie, Open Windows. Eric, was that worth seeing? I don't remember. I know you saw it.
If you're curious, it's not great. It's not horrible. I think it has a lot. There's good stuff in it, but ultimately it kind of falls flat by the end.
Okay. I agree with that, Eric. I agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's not much, you know, I mean, Time Crimes is good, but there's nothing that would suggest this guy would come up with something as cool and as great as this. This is a great surprise to have, you know, in the month of April. We got two movies out right now that are full of ideas and that are unpredictable and have characters that you are really invested in. This and Your Name are just top-of-the-line movie entertainment that people should definitely check out.
All right. Yeah, this is just this. it's the best movie I've seen all year, I was blown away by it. The originality of this movie, the creativity, where it goes, how surprising it is. And you're right, Colin. There is not a moment in this movie that where you're going to predict what's going to happen next. And if you think you know, you don't. And I was just I was kind of profoundly moved by it in a personal way, because it is an extraordinarily accurate and impressive film about codependency and alcoholism. And that's essentially what the underground, it's not even underground, it's what the film is really about. But it's also done in a way where it's very, very funny and very exciting. And it's a solid kaiju movie. Then the characters are really interesting and three dimensional. I think this might be the best performance Anne Hathaway's ever given, and I think she's great in it. And it's a really profound movie. It's a movie about really important subjects, and you don't think it's going to go down that road, but it does, and it does so in incredibly original and moving ways. And it works on so many levels. It's a movie that works on so many levels. It's astonishing that they were able to pull it off. Surprising in every way. And I know the less we talk about the least, you know, the less we talk about the plot and the surprises that are in the plot, the better. It's hard sometimes to, you know, it's kind of difficult to really go into detail as to why I love this movie as much as I love without giving certain things away. So I won't do that. Needless to say, I was really I was profoundly moved by this movie, and in a very personal way, and on top of it just being extraordinarily entertaining and really original and very, very just cool. It's my favorite film so far this year, and I plan on seeing it again and again and again. And I highly recommend that everybody see this movie. It's my favorite film so far this year. Now it's playing at 6 theaters in and around Chicago. It's playing at the River East. It's playing in Evanston. It's playing at the Landmark Century. It's playing in Yorktown, in Madison, in Addison at the Marcus Theaters, and it's also playing in Lincolnshire. Those are the theaters that it's playing at right now, and I highly recommend everybody see it. It is just so original and so great and so moving, and really profoundly interesting about subjects that you wouldn't expect to have in a giant monster movie.
Perfect final moment.
Unbelievable. No, it's just I love this movie, and I know Eric, you told me, you know, back when you reviewed this in Toronto, that I was going to probably flip my wig for it.
Oh yeah,
and I did big time. And you got my text right after I saw the movie.
Oh yeah.
So it's the best thing I've seen all year so far, and it's, you know, there's been a lot of really great movies that have come out so far this year, and this is the leader as far as I'm concerned. So that's colossal. All right. So next week, we've got Free Fire, which features a crazy cast in 70s gear shooting guns.
Yeah.
And then there's The Lost City of Z.
Mm-hmm.
Norman, which is Richard Gere's latest.
Yeah.
And then, now here's a thing. It says Donnie Darko, 15th anniversary. Donnie Darko came out 16 years ago.
Yeah.
They did the
anniversary overseas in the UK last year, and then they thought, well, let's do one in the US too. So that's why it's late. That's what I've
understand. And Nick, for a film that, you know, about, you know, alternate timelines, can you really begrudge it?
All right. Well, okay. All right. No, I'm just like, I was like, wait a minute. Donnie Darko came out in 2001. I specifically.
And I'm pretty sure the Music Box is doing both versions.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I would recommend the version that came out commercially.
Yeah,
that's the
for a week.
Yeah, I would recommend that over. And I know, I'm sorry, over Richard Kelly's director's cut, because I like the commercial version better.
Agreed.
You know, and the thing is, and I knew they ran his ass out of town after the box, didn't they?
Sure seems that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when you had Donnie Darko, you know, cult hit or not, and then you do Southland Tales.
Which is a masterpiece.
Yeah. And then, you know, The Box, which had a lot of ingredients for, you know, a potentially interesting science fiction horror movie.
Yeah.
And then people saw them like, what the heck was that?
I thought it was great.
Except us, of course.
I know. I thought it was great.
I loved it.
I've loved it.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah, we're fans.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love Donnie Darko, man. I always will. So that's the 16th anniversary of Donnie Darko next week. All right, so that's what we got next week. All right, and Colin, thanks, man.
Sure.
We will talk to you next week. Colin, everybody. Eric, you hang on.
Okay.
Eric's going to hang on. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll tell you all about the box office for this weekend right here on WGN. So stay tuned for that. Okay, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hi. How are you? It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time a little bit later on. We're going to talk about the best car movies and movie cars as well. 312-981-7200 for talk and text there. And right now, we're going to talk about box office. Eric Childress writes about a box office. He analyzes box office for movies.com, and he also talks about it on the TV. Tell everybody where people can see you, Eric.
Yeah, every Thursday morning on WYCC television, whatever channel that might be in your dial in the city and the suburbs. Just check it on your DVR, your TiVo, cable service, whatever. The show's called Business First AM. It's on 5 a.m. 5 days a week, and I am in the movies and money segment as we talk about the new movies that are coming out each week and analyze the box office potential for them.
All right. Okay, cool. Well, let's go. No surprise as to what number one was going to be this week.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody was surprised, but some people are surprised by how much, I guess, it didn't make. The Fate of the Furious made $100 million, which is good, but
yeah.
But didn't you, the last one made like $147 million opening weekend?
$147 million was the last one. And the thing is that, like, you know, we talked about a little bit during the review segment, is that, you know, each of these movies have gotten a little bit better, you know, for the most part. The last four, or at least the last three, were certainly better than the first four. I think most people will be in agreement in that.
Yeah.
So the quality was going up. The phenomenon was going up. And then with the seventh one, got all the press because of the unfortunate passing of Paul Walker.
Right.
So that, you know, that sort of elevated the film to a kind of you know, bigger event status, kind of in the same way that what happened with The Dark Knight and Heath Ledger.
Right.
So there was that on top of it, and, you know, people like the movie well enough. But I think that what you're seeing now, even though it did a huge, like, record-breaking worldwide box office this weekend, like $532 million worldwide.
Man.
Okay, that's including the $100 it did here in the U.S. I get the sense that this movie, especially when you see probably at the best the lukewarm response to it, that these movies, in the U.S. at least, may have peaked with the seventh film.
Mm.
That's what I'm seeing. I'm thinking. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see it come down to below $100 million when the final numbers are coming on Monday. And if the pattern holds from the last three movies, this movie's probably headed only somewhere between $230 to $245 million.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, you know, this movie is pretty much on course to make $1 billion. So if it makes a little less here in the U.S., so be it.
And what is this franchise made now? What
including what's made this weekend with the $500 million, $4.4 billion. Billion. This is the most successful franchise in the history of Universal. Some of the most successful films in the history of Universal. And it's a list that pretty much includes, like, the Illumination stuff, your Despicable Me's, your Minions,
yeah,
and a couple Jurassic Park,
yeah,
movies, basically.
Wow.
And E.T., of course.
Yeah, of course.
That's the list.
$4.4 billion.
Yeah, and by the end of this thing, we could be seeing it at $5 billion when this movie is the final numbers come in.
That is absolutely insane.
And they already have dates for the 9th and the 10th one.
That's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
All right. Number two, The Boss Baby, $15.5 million, bringing its total up to $116 million. That's solid.
It seems solid, but it's actually coming up as a little bit of a disappointment. You know, it had that really strong $50 million opening here in the U.S. The overseas numbers are decent. They're kind of matching what it's made here in the U.S. a little bit, just a little bit more than that. But it's still like $125 million production. So this film still needs about $115-120 million to break even.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's possible. I don't think you're going to see it maybe do more than another $30-40 million here in the U.S.
Yeah.
It could beat that. I mean, get another $80 million overseas, very possible. But it could be a minor hit, but it's nothing extraordinary.
Wow, it costs $125 million?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Number three, a juggernaut, Beauty and the Beast, $13.6 million. It's up to about $455 million total in America.
Yeah, by even this weekend, it'll be the 10th highest grossing film in the U.S. ever, passing Star Wars.
Wow.
Yeah, and it is headed, it already surpassed $1 billion, so it's now in the top 28 films worldwide grossing of all time.
That's incredible. Really is incredible. Number four is Smurf, The Lost Village, with $6.5 million, and number five, Going in Style, with $6.3 million, $23.3 million for Going in Style. And evidently, nobody went to see that one.
No. I mean, if Going in Style, I mean, that's kind of typical numbers for a movie of its type.
Yeah.
So I don't think Zach Braff's going to take too hard of a hit over it. I think they get $30-35 million out of that thing. I think they'll be very pleased.
Okay. All right. Well, next week, are we looking for this to repeat, Fate and Furious?
Yeah, there's nothing opening that's going to challenge it.
Right.
Lost City of Z is limited, and the only major release next week is Unforgettable, the Catherine Heigl Rosario Dawson domestic thriller, and that might do something in the teens or maybe a little bit higher.
Yeah, no, there's an audience. There's definitely an audience for that.
Yeah, but it's not going to be number one.
Right. Is anybody
number two?
Is anybody going to see Free Fire? Is that opening wide?
I don't think it's opening that wide. I think it's opening kind of a limited wide, maybe like 1,000 theaters.
Yeah.
I could be wrong on that. I haven't seen the final theater and count on that.
Right.
But I don't anticipate people going out there for that.
Okay. All right, man. Well, we will talk to you again next week.
Yeah, we'll do.
Thanks, Eric. Take care. That's Eric Childress. Read him at movies.com. For his box office analysis as well. All right, we got to take a break for the news here on WGN.